of Adam stalking through Eden without a fig leaf and slipped into the pool, crossing it several times with masterful strokes as I combed through my hair. When he was finished, he swam to the edge, his dark head as sleek as a seal's. He folded his arms on the warmed tile, resting his chin as he gave me a long look.
All right. Reveal all, I beg you.
I primmed my mouth in the manner of a student preparing a recitation. At 2:15 this afternoon, Lady Tiverton entered the establishment of Caswell & Co. Linen Drapers, where she proceeded to purchase... Wait for the shocking revelation, I beg you. Handkerchiefs.
Handkerchiefs? All that cloak and dagger nonsense from Figgy about following her stepmother and for handkerchiefs? How do you know?
A very helpful clerk was only too happy to reveal that they enjoyed Lady Tiverton's custom there. She chose very sober handkerchiefs woven with a narrow band of black at the edge.
Half mourning, he mused.
We were told that she still observed mourning for the first Lady Tiverton. We have never seen her in a colour other than grey, I agreed. I don't approve of the current fashion for ostentatious grief, but I must applaud her loyalty. Her affection for her predecessor strikes me as thoroughly sincere.
And yet Figgy is suspicious enough of her to track her like a bloodhound upon the most innocent of errands, Stoker said. To what end?
We fell silent a moment, contemplating that question. I formed my own theory, and the more I considered it, the more I liked it.
What?
Stoker demanded.
You're thinking something. I can always tell from the unholy light in your eyes when an idea strikes you.
One should not hypothesize without enough information, I reminded him. He gave me a stern look, one that was slightly mitigated by his current state of near nudity.
Kindly do not lecture me on scientific method. Now speak, woman.
Very well. It simply occurred to me that much of the colourful prose spilling from the pen of Mr. J. J. Butterworth is markedly detailed. Perhaps too markedly for someone outside the expedition. He was quick to seize the idea.
You think someone inside the expedition is feeding the blackguard information? Figgy?
I shrugged. Why not? We have already observed that she is a decidedly odd mix of child and adult. She is adventuresome enough to gad about town on her own. Why could she not have decided to supply the loathsome Butterworth with grist for his mill?
To what end? Stoker argued. The stories are upsetting to her father, whom she clearly adores.
Adores and deplores, I reminded him. Theirs is a prickly relationship. She might not mind upsetting him a trifle if it means distressing her stepmother. And the stories do vex Lady Tiverton. Besides which, you are overlooking the most obvious motivation. Members of the press have been known to remunerate their sources.
Not scrupulous ones, Stoker pointed out.
Does Mr. J. J. Butterworth strike you as particularly encumbered with such burdens as scruples?
Not especially, he admitted.
He shook his head.
I still cannot believe the girl would stoop so low.
I have a more thorough understanding of my own sex than you do, I said kindly. I know the horrors of which we are capable.
I have a little experience of that myself,
he reminded me dryly. Yes, but you think such monstrosities are an aberration. In your generous heart of hearts, you still believe we are good and gentle and everything men are not. You are, in short, my dear fellow, entirely too romantical about the crueler sex. He did not argue. Abruptly he flattened his palms on the tile and pushed, levering himself straight out of the water and onto the floor, like Poseidon rising from the deep. Rivulets of water cascaded from his body, shimmering over the taut muscles. A truly gracious woman would have looked away. Our exercises concluded, we returned to the Belvedere in our dressing gowns to collect the evening post, before returning to our respective abodes to prepare for dinner. As I put out my hand to the door, Stoker's fingers clamped about my wrist. Without a word, he nodded, and I saw that it was ajar. I never shrank from confrontation, but I was hardly dressed for battle, I reflected ruefully. I stepped back and let him take the lead, as I worked a sharpened hairpin out of my psyche knot purely as a precaution. We stepped inside, edging on silent feet towards the glow of light from the lamp that sat upon my desk. I was perfectly certain I had blown it out when I had finished my work, and we advanced as one, Stoker's hands clasped into loose fists, my hairpin at the ready. We paused behind a handy caryatid, exchanged glances, and silently mouthed a count of three before springing out from the shadows. Chapter 15. In the bedlam that erupted, I soon realized three things. One, our visitor was not bent upon harming us. Two, our visitor was Mrs. Marshwood. Three, she was not actually being strangulated by a weasel in spite of her shriek and the fur at her throat. It was meant to be decorative. She recovered herself quickly, putting a hand to her heart and fixing us with a repressive look. "How dare you come upon me like ruffians?" she demanded. "Is this any way to greet a caller?" Without waiting for a reply, she jerked her chin towards the enameled stove that formed the center of our little sitting area. "She is waiting for you. I tried to talk her out of this, but she insisted. I fear no good can come of it." Caroline de Morgan was seated before the stove in a porter's chair that had once graced Versailles. The silk brocade was shattered, the gilt wood splintered, but there was a suggestion of former glory about it. The lady herself was wrapped in a heavy coat of mouldering sables, no doubt a precaution against the chilly weather in her expectant state. I looked at Stoker. "I am surprised the two of you don't get on better. You both have such a fondness for dead animals." Caroline de Morgan raised her head and fixed me with a defiant stare.
"If that is your idea of a cordial greeting, I will take my leave now."
I bared my teeth in a smile. "Do close the door firmly behind you. There's such a draught otherwise." She curled a lip.
"My business is not with you. I have come to speak to him."
She gestured vaguely towards Stoker with a stick, and he heaved a sigh.
"I think we have said all that needs saying," he began.
She flapped her hand, startling the dogs. They had both taken refuge behind a cradle, a curious piece fashioned of half a tortoiseshell set in silver. They huddled behind the cradle, peering over the edge from safety. Cowards.
"There have been new developments," she informed us. "Can you not even bring yourself to offer the barest courtesies?" she demanded.
"Tea?"
Stoker asked sweetly.
"Coffee? Hemlock?"
She opened her mouth, no doubt to blast him, and I held up a hand. "That is enough from both of you. Yes, Mrs. de Morgan, I realize you came to speak with Stoker, but he is incapable of common courtesy in your presence. You bring out the worst in him. In his defense, I suspect you would drive the Pope himself to strong drink. Now, I give you my word that Stoker will not poison you, but I encourage you to keep your remarks brief and to the point. What do you want?" She did not like my taking charge of the situation, but if they were going to behave like recalcitrant schoolchildren, I was certainly capable of playing the nursery governess. She gave me a mutinous look and gestured towards a small carpet bag at her feet.
This is the only piece of baggage I brought out of Egypt. I want you to have it.
Why? Stoker demanded.
Because someone wants it, she said darkly. When I arrived from Dover, there was an attempt to take it from me at the train station. I thought nothing of it at the time. I presumed it was a common thief. The city is full of such blackguards, she said,
clearly preparing to give vent to her feelings on crime in the capital. I cut her off swiftly. There must have been a new attempt to take it. What happened? She gave me a look of grudging approval.
You have a brain, at least. I will give you that. Someone broke into our house last night. Specifically, they broke into my rooms.
Did you apprehend the fellow?
Stoker asked. Her expression was sour.
We did not, thanks to the ham-fisted foolery of that imbecile butler. He tripped over a rug and was knocked completely senseless. Poor Papa nearly had an apoplexy fighting the thief off.
Stoker lifted a skeptical brow.
Mr. Marshwood fought off a housebreaker?
Well, not so much fought him off as surprised him, she amended.
How do you know the housebreaker intended to steal the carpet bag? I asked.
Because it was in his hand. Papa surprised him and he dropped it as he fled.
Did he get a look at the fellow?
Stoker inquired.
Papa is not in the habit of consorting with thieves, she returned acidly. Such a person is naturally beneath his notice.
Stoker rolled his eyes at such snobbery, but I took a more patient tack. Do you believe you are in some sort of danger if you keep the bag on the premises?
How should I know? She demanded. But I will not have a repeat of it. Heaven knows what the villain will try next.
Stoker folded his arms over the breadth of his chest and cocked his head. There was an unholy light in his eyes.
If you truly believe you are in danger, you ought to hand that over to the Metropolitan Police.
The Metropolitan Police are a collection of fools and half-wits, she said,
her sables trembling in scorn.
They still believe I am quite possibly involved in a conspiracy with my husband. There is not a gentleman amongst them.
And you think to find one here?
Stoker challenged with a grim smile. She narrowed her eyes.
For all your sins, Revelstoke, and they are legion, you are a gentleman born and bred. You will not desert a lady in distress. It would be a violation of 800 years of breeding.
I wonder how much it cost you to admit that, he said softly.
She glared at him, and I moved once more to pour oil upon troubled waters. Leave it with us, Mrs. De Morgan.
I don't think so,
Stoker said in a dangerously even voice. Caroline De Morgan and I turned as one woman to stare at him. Stoker, I began.
I am not inclined to offer my assistance.
Of course you aren't, I said in a reasonable tone. But that shouldn't stop you from doing it. If there have been two attempts to recover the bag, there might be something significant about it. I broke off. How stupid of me. Of course there is something significant. Stoker flicked me an approving glance.
You begin to understand her. There is something she has not told us.
Caroline De Morgan opened her mouth, then snapped it shut as a tide of furious color rose in her cheeks.
Very well,
she managed finally. She thrust the bag at me, and I handed it to Stoker. He opened it far enough that we could peer inside. There were the usual items one might expect from a woman traveling abroad. A few toilet articles, a change of linen, a soiled shirtwaist. There was a romantic novel of the most torrid variety, something I should not have expected from Caroline De Morgan. These Stoker put to the side, revealing an apparently empty bag. I gave him a querying glance, but he had already anticipated my question. With a conjurer's quickness, he lifted out a false bottom. Beneath it nestled a pasteboard box, and I went to stand next to him as he opened it. On a bed of plain cotton wool lay the diadem of Princess Ankeset. The homely little nest did nothing to detract from its beauty. The sinuous lines, the glow of the gold, the glimmer of the jewels. I could well imagine the princess of the 18th dynasty settling the slender crown onto her oiled black braids, lifting her chin imperiously. Caroline de Morgan said nothing, but her gaze was mutinous as she watched us survey the little crown. "You have had this the whole time," I said, unable to keep the accusation from my tone.
"I did not know the diadem was there," she said quickly. "I did not travel with jewels and had no reason to open the hidden compartment. It was not until this morning when I was thinking about the attempt last night to steal it that I wondered
if John really was a thief."
Stoker finished flatly.
"If John took that diadem, he had his reasons," she insisted, "and I want to know what they were."
"Isn't it obvious?" I asked gently. "Apart from the mummy, this is the centerpiece of the Tiverton find. It is worth a great deal of money." Her glance to me was scornful.
"John would not have stolen it," she swore.
"Very true,"
Stoker said with quiet malice.
"After all, John de Morgan never took anything that didn't belong to him."
She gasped as if he had struck her. Then a slow, cruel smile spread over her face.
"How vicious you are. I never imagined the depths to which you could sink."
"Didn't you? You're the one who told the world what I was. Are you now so surprised to find proof of it?"
She stepped closer, raising herself to her full height.
"You will do this for me, Revelstoke."
"And how do you mean to compel me?"
he asked, his voice curiously detached.
"I know what happened last year. You did not even realize I saw, did you? But you thrashed John in plain sight of me. I can describe every filthy blow in sickening detail. I can tell the whole story and make certain everyone knows you are John's greatest enemy. I wonder, will your life stand up to scrutiny a second time?"
She flicked a glance to me.
"Won't your association with her prove interesting fodder for the newspapers? What exactly do you get up to here?"
she demanded, spreading her hands wide to encompass the chaos of the Belvedere.
"I call in broad daylight to find the pair of you not even respectably dressed. You're flushed and damp, the pair of you,"
she went on, dropping insinuation into every syllable.
"What have you been doing with yourselves? I will make certain the newspapers ask. And you know what journalists are, Revelstoke. Once they catch scent of the game, they will stop at nothing to run you to earth. You survived the last time. Do you really want to expose Miss Speedwell to their ugly tricks?"
She stopped, her color high with triumph, and I realized with a sickening jolt to my stomach that she was actually enjoying herself. Something about torturing him pleased her. She was the sort of woman who would pluck the wings from a butterfly and smile as she did so.
"Do you really think your own behavior could stand up to scrutiny?"
Stoker asked.
"I could tell them the truth, you know. I could tell them that I found you in John's tent. 3 months my wife, and yet you had your thighs around another man's waist. Shall I tell them that?"
Caroline de Morgan's knuckles turned white as she gripped the chair so hard I thought the wood would break under her grasp.
"You lie,"
she gasped, but the words were empty. She did not mean them. Something in his quiet litany of the facts had broken her resolve.
"Do I lie?"
he asked softly.
"Am I lying if I tell them that when a jaguar attacked me in the jungle, you and John left me for dead? Am I lying when I say that you knew the truth, and still you peddled your filthy fabrications to anyone who would listen? You painted me a brute and a monster, and all the while you knew what you were, didn't you?"
She opened her mouth, but Stoker's quiet voice cut across her, forcing her to silence.
"For the longest time I did not understand you, but I do now. You did what you must, didn't you? You told the only story you could, because to tell the truth meant admitting that you are a monster. You married me for money and a name, but your vows were a lie from the moment you spoke them. You wanted John. You loved John. But you could not stomach the notion of marrying a poor man, a man like your father and brothers. You wanted security more than anything, and you sold your soul to get it, but you couldn't face up to what you had done. Why? Did some flicker of guilt kindle in your soul? I suspect not. I suspect it was John who was remorseful about what the pair of you did to me. It didn't matter in the end. You both told the same story, the only story you could tell, that you left me because I was brutal to you."
She made a low moan of protest, but he spoke on, silencing her with his litany of accusations.
"I wonder sometimes if you took John just to prove that you could. He hated you at first. Did you know that? He warned me off marrying you, said I would regret it. Curious, isn't it, how right he was? I have had a lot of time to think of things as they were then. Do you know how many sleepless nights you can pass in a year? Two? Three? There isn't a night I close my eyes that I don't think of the mistakes I have made and the tragedies I have wrought with my own two hands, but they are nothing compared to what you have done."
Her mouth worked furiously, but she did not attempt to speak. I think she understood by then that the dam had broken, and Stoker would have his say, come the devil himself.
"It took me a long time to understand why John told me not to marry you. I thought he was jealous that I had found someone and he had not. It's because he already knew what you were, didn't he? He was so unhappy those last few months. That's why I wanted to take him to Amazonia. I thought he would recover something of himself, but that wouldn't have been possible, would it? He was already in love with a woman who did not deserve him, but he could not bear to tell me the truth about you. Still, he was wiser than I was. He knew you for what you were, and he loved you anyway. I loved only the illusion, the mirror face you chose to show me. I wonder which of us I pity more."
A silent, angry tear slid down her cheek. She did not brush it away. She wore it instead like a badge, defiantly, letting it run into the collar of her coat, wetting the fur.
"I won't make the mistake of thinking that tear is for me,"
he said. Each word weighted with pain.
"They are crocodile tears, and I do not believe them. I seem to recall John has an uncle, a baronet with a tidy fortune and a line of dead sons. Tell me, with John missing, who will inherit when that uncle dies? If the child you carry is a son, you will have control of it. The estate, the money. Quite a pretty packet. And you don't even need John, do you? You are wed, so any child born to the marriage is legally his. As long as that baby is healthy and male, whoever controls the child controls the fortune. Tell me I am wrong."
With each word, she had lowered her head, beaten down by the weight of his accusations. But at his command she flung her head up, defiance kindling in her eyes.
What of it? Do you think to sit in judgment of me, Revelstoke? What do you know of being a woman? Of suffering the whole of your life for the mistakes the men in your family have made? My father, my brothers, my husband, over and over the same story, letting everything slip through their fingers. Through what? Carelessness? Stupidity? Women, horses, bad investments, gambling, 1,000 excuses, but it all comes back to the same thing. Your sex is weak,
she said, fairly spitting the words.
It is always down to us to make of life what we can, to recover from your mistakes and to carry on. Yes, I want the De Morgan fortune. I admit it. We are very nearly destitute, and my child's inheritance is the only thing standing between us and ruin. I will do whatever I must to secure it. I will have a son, and I will take what is mine. Does that make me a monster? It makes me a survivor,
she spat. Before Stoker could speak, I moved to take the diadem out of his hands. They were tightening into fists around the crown, and already I could see the box bending. I replaced the lid and set the box to the side. I repacked the carpet bag and handed it to Caroline De Morgan. Your property, Mrs. De Morgan. We will keep the crown, and we will discover what happened to your husband. Not because of your feeble attempt at blackmail, but because it is the right thing to do. I am certain that motivation is foreign to you, but you will have to accept it. She darted a look at Stoker.
Is that all? Are you going to set your lapdog on me?
I stepped between them just as Stoker moved. You enjoy your games, Mrs. De Morgan. That much is obvious. And baiting Stoker obviously gives you tremendous pleasure. But let me make one thing perfectly clear. So long as I draw breath, you will not hurt him again. She gave me a thin smile, drawing her sables about her with an imperious air.
And who are you to stop me?
I am the woman who knows 20 ways to kill you, and all of them with pain, I told her with an answering smile. Now, take your carpet bag and your decaying mother and leave. If you come here again, I will not be answerable for my actions. She pointed to the crown, and her hand was steady.
Judge me however you like. I care not. Just find my husband. I know you will not refuse me, no matter what has passed before. Your honour will not permit it.
Her lip curled as she looked at Stoker.
As I said, your sex is weak. If my unborn child were Miss Speedwell's enemy, she would cut its throat in the cradle. We are the daughters of Hera, Miss Speedwell. It is what keeps us alive. I will see myself out.
It was not until the door slammed behind her that the dogs brought their heads above the edge of the cradle. I did not look at him. I went instead up to the snuggery and poured a glass of aguardiente, a double measure, and drank it off. I poured another and handed it to him as he appeared at the top of the stairs. He drank his slowly, holding the bitterness on his tongue. You are 40 kinds of a fool, I said finally. I cannot believe that you loved such a creature, that you, with all your gifts, could have been blinded by beauty to so much malice.
Believe it,
he replied simply. I poured a second measure of aguardiente for myself and another for him. He stared into the little cup as a gypsy scrying his fortune. Then he gave a laugh, bitter and mirthless. What? I demanded. You cannot be drunk yet. You've scarcely begun.
She is right, you know.
All this time, all that has happened, and she still knows me better than anyone because she knows what I endured without a word. All that public humiliation, the agony of my name being dragged through the mud, never to be clean again. She was right to call me weak.
What does she know? I sipped at the aguardiente, warming my belly with the fire of it. He shook his head and looked at me with eyes that seemed to have seen a thousand years.
Everything the newspapers printed about me,
he said in a hollow voice.
The beatings and the mistreatment. It's all lies. I never touched a hair of her head.
Stoker, I never thought you really visited violence upon your wife. It is not in your nature to bring harm to the innocent.
The innocent. God, to think of her in those terms. But she was innocent, at least where I was concerned.
He broke off, giving me a level look. You mean you did not?
Never.
But she was your wife.
She played the part of the coy maiden well during our courtship. She never let me so much as kiss her. I pressed her hand and thought myself privileged. When our wedding night came, I took her into my arms to kiss her, and she began to tremble. I did not mind. I was no virgin, but I was scared, so frightened of hurting her. I thought we could be terrified together. And that's when she told me she could not.
She refused you?
Categorically. And she made it clear that she was not prepared to be a wife to me, in the fullest sense of the word, ever.
I thought of him as he must have been then, before life and time and pain had changed him. He must have been so handsome it hurt to look at him, offering his heart to her. And she had twisted it in her hands, mangling it as a child will break a toy. Hatred, hot and violent and satisfying, coursed through my veins, drumming a rhythm in my head. "You might have annulled her," I said in a voice I did not recognize. He looked surprised.
"It never occurred to me. I was prepared not to have her body if it meant I could have her heart. That she pretended to give. She was affectionate and sweet, and I thought she meant it. I believed that over time I could bring her to share my bed, if only I was patient enough, kind enough. I did not yet realize she refused me her maidenhead because she could not bear the touch of my hands upon her. And all because I was not John."
He laughed, that peculiar, unhappy sound that twisted my guts.
"What kind of fool loses his wife to his best friend?"
"You weren't a fool," I said slowly. "You were in love with her." He looked at me in surprise.
"In love with her? It seems impossible now, but I thought so. I thought it was love. But I was so very wrong. I have never known love. At least not until..."
He broke off sharply and took a swift drink. My heart thudded against my ribs, and I was conscious of a single thought. Not like this. I changed the subject with brutal haste. "Why did she marry you if she was in love with John de Morgan?" He waved an impatient hand.
"He was poor, and his prospects were worse. Her parents would have permitted the match, but Caroline tortured him. She mocked his poverty and teased and tormented him. I thought it was silly banter, the games a comely girl will play with a suitor she does not mean to have. I excused her cruelty at the time, but it ought to have warned me. I ought to have seen her for what she was."
He passed a hand over his face.
"God help me, I did. I did see the cruelty in her, and I mistook it for a game. I never realized she meant it. I thought her wild and dangerous and exciting, and she was exactly what my parents wanted for me, beautiful and accomplished. She danced like an angel and spoke good French, and that was supposed to be enough. But John knew.
What were his feelings? He spread his hands helplessly.
I don't even know. He said almost nothing about her except that feeble attempt to talk me out of marrying her. I even joked that he was jealous, and he laughed with me. I ought to have seen he was half sick with longing for her. They could not be within 20 feet of each other, or they quarrelled. I was so naive, he said,
taking up the cup to drain it.
I thought they merely needed time to get to know one another better. It was important to me, I told them, that they become friends. I insisted upon the Amazonian trip as a means to bring them closer together.
He curled one lip in disgust.
Do you have any idea how much I have hated myself?
For what?
For all of it. For falling for her machinations and marrying her when I could not see her for what she was. For not understanding her or myself. For not pushing John to tell me what was really in his heart.
He paused.
Did you ever read mythology when you were a child?
Insatiably.
So did I. I was always affected by those couples who seemed destined for one another. Eurydice and Orpheus, Hero and Leander, Pyramus and Thisbe. I thought at some point in my life I would have a great love like that, a woman fashioned by the gods just for me, as I had been made just for her, that we would find each other. I always believed she was waiting for me. But I did not wait for her. I married a base metal when the gods had promised me gold.
He gave a great sigh that seemed to empty him from the soul. How did John come to marry her in the end, if he knew her true character? His expression was bereft.
Because she got into his soul. And there is no cure for a man when a woman does that. She seduced him on the expedition, caught him in a moment of weakness, and when they were discovered and I was halfway to death's door, they would have had only one way out then. They had to paint me as vicious a devil as they could. It was the only chance they had to salvage their life together. They sacrificed me to purchase a future. And I know what that cost John. He sold every last scrap of his self-respect when he did that to me. That is why he stood still and let me beat him when we finally came face to face. Every blow I landed drew blood, and never once did he lift a finger to stop me.
His mouth twisted at the memory.
And when I had knocked him to the ground and you could hardly see his face for the blood, do you know what he did? The bastard smiled at me. He raised his hand in forgiveness and he smiled at me. And I turned on my heel and walked away. I left him, bleeding into the gutter without a backwards glance.
He put aside the cup.
So now you know the worst of me, Veronica. It isn't that I killed a man in Brazil, or bought prostitutes, or spent my youth in 1,000 debaucheries. It is that my greatest pleasure in life has been beating a man nearly to death because he took what I loved. We are not supposed to rejoice in the pain of others, but it feeds me. Every time I think of him, taking what ought to have been mine, my wife, my name, and paying for it with his heart's blood, I am glad of it.
There are those who would tell you to give up such bitterness, I told him. That kind of hatred will only poison you from within. He gave me a cold smile.
Do not fear for me, Veronica. The devil takes care of his own.
It was Stoker's idea for me to wear the diadem to the Tiverton reception at Karnak Hall that evening. You must be joking, I told him flatly. It does not suit what I am wearing. I had donned my best evening gown, a severely cut violet satin that flattered my figure and the color of my eyes. Innocent of the usual furbelows and embellishments, it boasted neither ruffles nor rosettes, only a graceful fall of fabric from a gently gathered bustle, and a precise, almost military sharpness to the pin-tucks. Stoker regarded me from the top of my neatly coiled hair to the tip of my purple evening slippers. He canted his head, studying my appearance with the critical eye of an artist.
"I rather think it will do. The gown is quite plain, and you have no jewels. Against that witch-black hair of yours, the coronet will show to good effect."
"I cannot simply appear wearing the crown of Princess Ankeset," I protested. "In the first place, it is stolen property that must be returned to the Tibetans."
"They won't mind," he said dismissively. "No doubt the newspapers will have sent representatives, and seeing it displayed on the head of a beautiful woman will garner them inches in the press."
I ignored the compliment. It was not intended as such. Stoker was a scientist and merely made observations. If he thought me beautiful, it was only because of an accidental arrangement of proportions and features over which I had no control and could claim no credit. "I am not supposed to be making a spectacle of myself in the press, or had you forgot? My family won't like it."
"Your family can hang for all I care," he said succinctly.
"Save your republican notions," I warned him. "We cannot possibly explain this to the satisfaction of the Tibetans."
"Leave that to me,"
he replied, with the assurance of a man whose blood ran blue.
"Besides, you are overlooking one important factor. If you appear wearing the diadem, we have the element of surprise. We already suspect Figgy and Lady Tiverton separately of some mischief. We can observe their reactions."
I hesitated. The scheme, while theatrical in the extreme, did appeal to me. While I pondered, Stoker reached out and slipped half a dozen pins from my hair. "That took the better part of an hour," I protested. He ignored me entirely and busied himself redressing my hair until it tumbled about my shoulders, only the front half of it winged back, baring my temples. He lifted the diadem from its cotton nest, carefully settling it onto my hair. It fitted low on the brow, circling my head, and might have been a trifle too large but for the pinned locks that filled it snugly. He smoothed the slim golden ribbons, drawing one along either side of my face to frame it, and letting the others trail down the back, mingling with the tresses he had freed. He stepped back to observe his handiwork, scrutinizing from every angle.
"It will do,"
he pronounced finally. He handed me a mirror, a chinoiserie piece from a collection once belonging to Catherine the Great, and awaited my verdict. The violet of the gown highlighted the blue of the lapis and the purple of the plummy agates, while the carnelians blazed orange fire with incendiary contrast. The effect was startling, and from the collarbone up, I looked quite unlike a modern Victorian woman. "I suppose you are right," I told him, with more reluctance than I felt. "Let us bait a mousetrap, and I shall be the cheese." Chapter 16 The hansom drew up to the curb in front of Karnak Hall, and I marvelled at the difference a few days had made. The atmosphere was positively electric as carriages arrived, dispensing the great and the good dressed in their finest. Several of the ladies sported Egyptian-themed jewels or gowns, and I realized my diadem might not occasion as much discussion as Stoker and I had expected. The Metropolitan Police were in evidence as well. Caped bobbies strolled past, their uniforms smart, their buttons shined to brilliance, no doubt in honor of the expected arrival of the Prince of Wales. A few members of Special Branch milled about the crowd, keeping themselves discreetly at the edge of the gathering. I caught a brief glimpse of Morna Day, deep in conversation behind a potted palm. Ever the flirt, he had managed to find a slender young woman to dally with, although his expression was serious. I could not see hers, for her back was turned, but I was not surprised Morna Day had singled her out. He had an unfashionable partiality to ginger hair, I recollected with a smile. Stoker and I proceeded into the hall in search of our hosts. Sir Leicester and Lady Tiverton were in the lobby, greeting guests as they arrived. The baronet was dressed in traditional evening wear, and his lady wore a silk gown of dove grey, unremarkable except for her own quiet grace, and a spectacular necklace of Egyptian design. Her complexion was paler than I had seen it yet, with soft plum shadows beneath each eye. Her hand was laid upon her husband's sleeve, the fingers curled protectively. She looked up as we approached, the first to see us, and gave a little gasp. The noise drew the attention of her husband. Sir Leicester swiveled his head like an owl, his gaze moving instantly to the diadem.
"Miss Speedwell!"
he exclaimed, his eyes fairly popping from their sockets. I fixed a bright smile. "I thought you would be pleased to see we have recovered it."
"Pleased is not the word," he began.
Stoker stepped up to my elbow.
"We hoped that you would be so pleased you would overlook my gaucherie in persuading Miss Speedwell to wear it. A little joke," he finished.
Sir Leicester eyed the diadem.
"I don't know,"
he hesitated.
"It is, of course, a very valuable and ancient artifact."
Before Stoker could reply, Patrick Fairbrother approached, looking harried.
"Sir Leicester, I am sorry, but there is some question about the lighting of the dais when the sarcophagus is revealed, and I did not like to decide—"
He broke off as he caught sight of the diadem.
"I say, Miss Speedwell, is that? Can it be?"
"It is," I replied, putting a tentative fingertip to the vulture hovering just above my brow.
"But where? How did you recover it? Have you found John de Morgan?"
Lady Tiverton asked anxiously.
"We have not," Stoker told her. "And we are happy to disclose how we happened to gain possession of the diadem, but not now. You have guests to whom you must attend. I presume this is the coronet that went missing when De Morgan disappeared?"
He raised his brows, surveying the small group of Egyptologists.
"Most assuredly,"
Sir Leicester pronounced. He looked at Stoker.
"I am still not persuaded that letting Miss Speedwell wear it is the soundest proposition."
"Oh, but sir," Fairbrother broke in, "forgive me, but I think it a most excellent notion."
He glanced over his shoulder towards the collection.
"We did not anticipate its recovery, so we have no suitable vitrine for its display. The best we could do is jostle it in amidst the pots and canopic jars, and that hardly seems fitting. Far better to let it be shown to such superb effect upon the head of a lovely woman,"
he finished, bowing slightly. His patron sighed.
"I suppose you are right, Patrick."
He turned to his wife.
"What say you, my dear?"
She smiled.
"Miss Speedwell looks quite magnificent. I think it could not be displayed half so well in any other fashion."
Sir Leicester nodded slowly.
"All right, then, Miss Speedwell. I suppose I need not impress upon you the enormity of the responsibility you have taken on. You bear the weight of antiquity upon your head."
I murmured something suitable and turned to Lady Tiverton. "The crown is certainly remarkable, but your own jewel is very nearly as fine," I said, nodding to the thickly beaded collar at her throat.
"Do you like it, Miss Speedwell?"
she asked, touching the necklace with a tentative fingertip.
"It is a pectoral piece once belonging to Princess Ankeset.
She pitched her voice low.
My husband excavated it. It is a point of pride with him, and it is in tribute to Celesta that I wear it, although I must confess I feel unworthy.
He caught the last of her statement and patted her hand.
None of that,
he said firmly.
It becomes you. And no doubt will further excite interest in the treasures you have brought out of Egypt,
Stoker said with calculated blandness.
Indeed, sir, indeed,
Sir Leicester agreed. He adopted a confiding tone.
I understand Figgy came to see you. I hope she didn't make a nuisance of herself.
Not at all, I said. She was calling upon Lady Wellingtonia and was interested in our work at the Belvedere. She is welcome at any time.
I am glad to hear it.
Before he could reply further, Lady Tiverton gestured towards the decor of the hall.
Was it not the greatest stroke of luck that we were able to secure this hall to display the finds? The setting is most atmospheric, is it not?
The interior of the hall was much the same as the outside, all Egyptological paintings and terracotta-coloured walls. Here and there, potted palms gave the impression of the out-of-doors, and the carpet was the colour of stone.
Most atmospheric, I agreed. Naturally, we have attempted to improve the decorations, she added,
indicating the long linen banners hung at the main doorway into the hall.
Poor Mr. Fairbrother only just finished supervising the hanging of the banners before the doors were opened.
The banners were decorated with the cartouche of Princess Ankeset and images of lotus flowers and gods, all rendered in gilt paint and brilliant reds and ochres and blacks. I could almost fancy myself in ancient Egypt, I said, nodding to Mr. Fairbrother. He smiled down at me.
Your praise is more than I deserve, but I will accept it with pleasure.
The banners are lovely, Mr. Fairbrother, I assured him.
They were devilishly difficult to install, he said,
bending his head close to mine.
I had to strip to the waist and climb like an athlete to get them into place. I only wish you had been here to see it.
With a rush of pleasure, I realized Patrick Fairbrother was flirting with me. I tipped my head and made good use of my lashes. I regret that I was not, I said in a low voice. He grinned at me.
Come and see the exhibition, he urged. It really is quite astonishing.
Stoker had fallen into conversation with Sir Leicester, and Lady Tiverton was welcoming another party, so I accepted the arm that Patrick Fairbrother offered. He guided me through the doorway into the expanse of the hall itself. I stood on the threshold for a moment, dazzled by the brilliant blue gleam of faience, the warm glow of the gold.
Magnificent, isn't it?
His breath stirred the slender gold ribbon at my ear. Entirely magnificent, I said, in perfect honesty. Like the foyer, the inner hall had been furnished with potted palms and hung with linen banners to conjure a scene out of ancient Egypt. With Fairbrother as my guide, I was introduced to the Tiverton collection. He pointed out simple things like gilded wooden chairs and screens, noting the workmanship and explaining the symbols. But his real enthusiasm was for the jewels. Startlingly bright beaded strings in delectable colours, carnelian red, lapis blue, jade green, and everywhere the burnished brilliance of gold. He showed me a tiny gazelle, poised mid-leap, and a set of hair combs fashioned with such delicacy they would have suited only a royal head.
"But here is the piece that made me think instantly of you,"
he said, pointing to a necklace that had been displayed outside of any case, hung almost carelessly upon the neck of a pottery vase. It was a slender strand of beads, rather short so that it must fit close at the base of the throat, and composed of alternating materials, gold and lapis, From the center, a single charm depended, a graceful butterfly, its lapis wings unfurled, the delicate veins marked with fine threads of gold.
"Remember what I told you about butterflies in the tombs of the pharaohs," he said in a low voice. "Resurrection and beauty."
"Exquisite," I breathed. I put out a fingertip as if to touch the cartouche, but he grabbed my hand.
"Miss Speedwell, you mustn't," he cautioned with a smile. "Look, but do not touch."
As if to ensure my compliance, he kept my hand clasped in his as I admired the necklace. After a long moment, he stopped a passing waiter to secure two glasses of champagne.
"It has cost us much to bring these treasures out of Egypt, but tonight is our triumph. Drink a toast with me, Miss Speedwell."
"Very well. What are we toasting?" I asked, accepting the glass.
"To unexpected adventures," he said,
holding my gaze as he touched his glass to mine. "To Princess Ankhesett," I added, gesturing to the draperies which concealed the sarcophagus on the dais. "May she rest in peace." He smiled a wary smile.
"You do not approve of the public display of the coffin?"
I shrugged. "Not exactly. I understand the need for knowledge, but perhaps in a more private venue, for scholars only," I suggested. "Rather less of a fairground attraction." The smile warmed.
"Well, perhaps you have a point," he began.
Suddenly, something brushed my leg, and I moved quickly to the side, pressing myself inadvertently against Mr. Fairbrother's muscular form.
"It's only Newt," he said,
coaxing the dog out from behind my skirts.
"But I shall thank her for that," he added,
with a meaningful glance. Lady Tiverton approached then, her expression slightly harried.
"Patrick, I'm afraid Newt will make a nuisance of herself. Figgy was supposed to keep her close at hand, but she must have forgot."
I had glimpsed Figgy darting behind the dais as her stepmother approached, her expression mulish. She was dressed in a youthful frock of yellow dimity, a dreadful colour on her, and she had spent the better part of the evening skulking behind the potted palms, staring balefully at the crowd. Parties, it seemed, were not her favourite diversion. Fairbrother downed the rest of his champagne in one swallow, and took the dog by the collar.
"Come along, little brute," he said with some fondness. "Let's go and find you a chicken to eat."
"Thank you,"
Lady Tiverton called after him. She gave me a small smile.
"I am sorry to have interrupted,"
she began in a faltering voice. "There was nothing to interrupt. Mr. Fairbrother was simply being hospitable," I assured her.
"I apologize if Newt alarmed you. She's a dear, really, but she can be terribly excitable, and Figgy will forget to look after her."
She touched me lightly on the arm.
"About her visit, I do hope she did not make a nuisance of herself."
Poor Figgy, I thought. Little wonder the child felt suffocated if her call had already occasioned such interest. I repeated what I had told Sir Leicester, and Lady Tiverton nodded.
"She scarcely knows Lady Wellingtonia. Calling upon her was merely a pretext."
She hesitated, then darted a glance to where Stoker was still in conversation, his manly form shown to advantage in the stark perfection of his evening clothes, his expression serious. In spite of his untamable hair and his earrings, he looked like a master of creation.
"He is a difficult man to ignore, and Figgy is an imaginative creature,"
she said, leaving the statement hanging in the air. "You need have no fear, my lady. Miss Tiverton is as safe with Stoker as with a monk. His manners may be occasionally rough, but he is every inch a gentleman, cradle-born. The grave eyes rounded in horror.
Miss Speedwell, you must not think